Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And this Monday, we are continuing our journey through Matthew Weiner's The Romanovs. This was episode 4, Expectation. Jim, I was excited about this episode because I really love Amanda Peet. I really love John Slattery. What did you think of this episode?
I thought it was pretty engaging for the most part. There are a couple of scenes that really fell flat to me because I think of the format of this show. But for the most part, yeah, I found myself pretty engaged, especially by the performance from Amanda Peet. I thought she was actually really good. Her character, it's, I guess, tough for me to relate to her character, but a lot of the ways they tell this story really helps me understand where she's coming from. And same for John Slattery's character. Of, I think Daniel is his name in this. Mm-hmm. I found that story pretty engaging.
It's interesting because for me, this episode is where the wheels of the show completely fell off.
I mean,
I've seen Amanda Peet play unlikable characters before, like Saving Silverman, but there's always been like a comic sensibility to it. Maybe it's because this is just another instance of Matthew Weiner playing the genre conventions, but I felt like a lot of this stuff was shot and scripted as a comedy, but everyone, it has the sensibilities of a drama, or if it is supposed to be funny, I just wasn't laughing. So it just, yes, Amanda Peet did an excellent job of playing a fundamentally unlikable character, but that to me is not enough. The only thing I liked about this episode, it was just barely over an hour. So, because I was looking at the 1/3 mark, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it's going to be. And then I noticed that there's only 30 minutes left. I'm like, oh, okay.
well, that doesn't say anything good. No. About the episode, for
like,
sure.
I hated this, and I thought it was like, just judging from the other reviews it's gotten, I was going to go online and find like a near universal panning, but I find that there is a lot of people really liking the things going on this episode. So I guess maybe this is for a particular type of person. It speaks to a particular type of person, or it speaks to something that Matthew Weiner wants to say that I'm just not getting, because I mean, I guess I'm really glad that you liked it, because that'll be an interesting conversation. Before we get too much further in the episode, I want to talk about some things that are going on here at baldmove.com. But first, of national interest, if you're an American, we have an election next week, next Tuesday, November 6th, that's coming up. And just like we encourage everyone to register to vote in the months leading up to it, I'd like to obviously encourage everyone to participate. If you're looking for a good nonpartisan voter's guide, you can find one at vote411.org. They have ballots for every race across the country. And they've got interviews with the candidates each position, and you could print out your own ballot and take it to the polls, so you can be organized about it if you'd like to. But it's very important. Obviously, people have fought and died for our right and our privilege to do so. So please participate in democracy this next Tuesday. Also, Season of the Cage blew in hard and fast at baldmove.com. That's our
a hard and fast turn of topics. But yes, Season of the Cage is upon us.
It is. It's our first in a series of super serious film fests where we do an in-depth look at a particular actor or series of movies. This is Season of the Cage talking about the best of his movies and the worst of his movies. We're on the uphill stretch right now. Last week we talked about The Rock. This week, a more dramatic turn in The Weatherman. So we've got live watches, we've got in-depth podcasts, we've got our attempts to rewrite a sequel or prequel of The Weatherman. All that is on baldmove.com. We also are considering The Deuce on Tuesday. We got another episode or two of that left. Cecily and I are considering American Horror Story on Wednesday nights with the instant take, and then Feedback Fridays the Friday after that. And last, and probably least, remind everyone that pre-sales of my book, God of Thrones, a book about the religions of Westeros and Game of Thrones, is coming out October or November 1st. And you can actually pre-sale it on Amazon right now. There'll be a link in the podcast for that. And if you're a Game of Thrones fan in general, George Martin's coming out with a book later this month, Fire and Blood, and I'm going to be blowing off the dust of the Game of Thrones feed. I've got some podcasters that are going to do guest spots with me. I'm going to be doing some segments with Anthony, my co-author of Gods of Thrones. and it should be a lot of fun. So check out the Game of Thrones podcast feed on baldmove.com.
Yeah, I mean, the part that you just explained about, you know, this essentially feeling like a comedy and also this very serious dramatic thing at the same time, I feel like that is what Matthew Weiner got away with a lot of the time on Mad Men.
Yep.
That the format here really lets him down on. He simply can't do the same things that he did in Mad Men with the moments that stand out to me in this episode as awkward and not making much sense are like that first conversation with her daughter where they're right. screaming back and forth. I don't know who these people are. Why do I care?
Yes.
None of this history that you have with like Mad Men characters that is so firmly baked into their foundations comes through here. Yeah, because you don't have it, right? So you can't do the same things. And I feel like he's trying to use those tricks. The other scene is the outburst in the car, which I think is supposed to be comedy, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really come across as that to me. So I think we have some of the same problems. I guess I just found the core story more engaging.
Maybe that's the entire premise, because like the whole time, I guess I'm trying to judge like whether people are, you know, behaving in appropriate ways that are out of their character. Like if this is a fundamentally good person that's acting crazy and bizarrely because they're under a lot of stress, like I think you're supposed to understand that, but I didn't get a baseline. So like everyone kind of read awful, like mm-hmm. you're right. This mother and daughter are having this fight, and the one mother is scolding her daughter for, you know, living a conventional lifestyle, and the daughter shouting back, oh, you're just in a feminist socialist rage. And I'm like, in a vacuum, what the hell? How do you score that? Who's winning? Who's losing? Yeah. Is this woman's lifestyle with like her husband really like good, or is it like I had no frame of reference. And like as the episode continued to went, there's a couple things I thought were interesting that it did. Like I really liked the wordless fight that John Slattery and Amanda Peet as Juliet and Daniel had in that bookstore.
Yeah, the one that they keep revisiting throughout the episode.
But then you just hit on my complaint that like I thought that's like, huh, like we've seen a million of these fights and they're always fundamentally unfair and self-serving to each side. It's kind of an interesting choice to just show the fight and other people's reactions and its relatively inappropriateness in the place of the bookstore. And then when they kept coming back and filling that fight in, I thought like, well, shit, that was the one interesting idea that this episode played with. And now they're kind of throwing it away because, I mean, broadly speaking, this is about a middle-aged person feeling like as they are supposed to be ascending to some master of the universe or having some kind of like real control over their life, they're realizing their children are adults and they're doing things differently and making mistakes that they wouldn't make. But then the episode is always there to remind us, well, also, she made a mistake a long time ago that could threaten to destroy her entire life. And then at the end, it kind of asks us, but really would it destroy her life? Because, mm-hmm. like, look at they have Amanda Peet just ludicrous freaking out about a minor surgery and how she might die before she meets her grandchild, which admittedly is always a chance anytime you go into general. It's like everything she's saying is true, but it's just silly catastrophizing. But I don't know. So, like, is having an affair and raising an illegitimate daughter to think that, like, is that a minor mistake? Obsessing about general anesthesia or worrying if your daughter's not a good enough feminist? Or is it like a really big fucking life altering thing that maybe you should have a little bit of, like dread and terror that your life is built upon this central lie? I don't know.
Yeah. I thought like so many of the things that you mentioned, the more minor of the mistakes were mm-hmm. kind of the maelstrom around this nexus of, you know, the mistake she made so long ago and the mistake she's continuing to make by lying about it. Because I think you're right. At the end, we're supposed to think, would this actually destroy her life? I mean, it would change her life dramatically, potentially, depending on how Eric reacts to it. But is that a destruction of her life or is that just a transformation of her life? Right. And if her daughter already knows, how much easier does that make it?
Right.
And I guess the end of the episode also encourages you to ask, is it even important to do at this point? Mm-hmm. You know, this amazing, what I thought was an amazing scene in the confession that was a fantasy, never actually happened.
Which, oh my God, I hate it so much.
I figured you probably would. I found myself going, oh, really? Really, they're going to do this to us? But that scene was probably the best of the episode, in my opinion. And then it questions, like, well, is that necessary at this point? Do you need to go to Eric? Do you need to say, hey, you know, I've been living with this lie forever? Or do you need to just let it lie because the daughter knows?
Well, I mean, yeah, like... so the problem with that scene for me is that all of the sympathy is for essentially Juliet and Daniel, and maybe a little for the daughter, but there's none for the husband who's been living this lie this whole time, right? And has no mm-hmm. awareness of it. And, you know, Amanda Peet's character is coming forward with the truth because she is worried about her ex-lover's feelings. Because this has nothing to do with her daughter, who we find out, I think, you know, that's something I want to ask you about. It's clearly you believe that she does know. Like we think that her daughter's known all along. Maybe her husband's in the dark. Maybe he kind of knows and just overlooking at it. But, like, to me, this feels like, you know, this gallstone that she's got inside of her, and she needs to get it out, not because it's going to make everybody else's life better, but because it'll make her feel better. And yeah, that's kind of shitty. But also, like, to expect, like, will this destroy her life or not? Again, I don't have enough information. Like, is her husband completely supporting her and allowing her to fuck around at the homeless shelter so she feels fulfilled and she has no way of sustaining herself? Because, yeah, if he throws her out and gets a divorce, then maybe that would ruin her life.
Well, I mean, but then she goes with Daniel, who they're clearly still in
sure,
love.
Yeah.
And he's a successful Romanoff historian, apparently, and author.
Right.
So, no, I don't think it's going to, like, devastate her in that kind of way, but it'll change things.
Yeah, but then he throws his wife over, and what's she got? It's kind of like this talk about this cascading loss of control she has. Like, I think there's but yeah, like, again, there wasn't enough information. This is too big of a story to tell in 60 minutes, I feel like.
Which is
actually
funny.
Yeah, to kind of keep score, like, try to figure out, like, was this right? Is this good? Is this wrong? Is this moral? Is this ethical?
Yeah, here's the thing. I'm not trying to keep score in this episode, though. This is a tale of a woman who is dealing with a secret that she has kept for 20 years.
Right.
And it's, like, I'm not looking to say, oh, she's right or wrong by doing this. Just how it affects her, how much better she feels when somebody knows her secret, when she doesn't have to hold on to that just by herself. Those are the kinds of things I'm thinking as I'm watching this episode. Not like, oh, who's winning here? You know, because nobody's winning. Everybody's fucking losing. But does everybody have to continue to lose, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I might have chosen my words poorly when I said keeping score. I guess what I'm saying is, like, you feel grounded in the narrative and understanding the stakes. Because they're... Is just a lot, I don't know, just a lot of gauzy stuff I don't identify with here. I guess that's the other problem, is that Amanda Peet's characterization, like, I don't know of any, I don't know. I guess she doesn't seem like a real character to me. Like, she's just this mass of contradictions. I don't know.
She felt like me, to me, like a woman who was searching for some kind of absolution from her sins.
Right.
And the one thing that she couldn't do was the only thing that would ever give her any kind of peace, which is to tell somebody, to tell her husband, to tell her daughter, to tell somebody what's been going on. And her search for that was this episode. And it finally comes down to the gallstone thing.
Yeah. But when you say the one thing she couldn't do, I don't understand why she couldn't do that. Like, why was that such a scary decision? I mean, it always felt like a purely selfish decision.
Sure. No, I won't argue with that. I'm simply saying it's a very, very hard thing to do, to come clean to someone like that.
Yeah.
With this thing that's been festering for 20 years.
Right.
So I'm surprised you can't understand a struggle like that.
I mean, I guess I can't understand a struggle. Like, Why?
You're saying, I mean, if you're saying like all healthy people should easily have no problem coming clean, yes, but she's not healthy. It's clear that she's not healthy.
But I don't understand. Like, I don't understand her struggle. Like, I guess that's the thing. Is like, this is a woman who is like has literally it all. She could do any million things from here by coming clean and removing this stain from her family and moving forward. And she's not trapped in a abusive relationship. She's not trapped in a high pressure job that she couldn't just walk away from. She's not. You know, her child's not addicted to drugs or in a dangerous relationship. She's just like, it just felt like an attractive middle-aged woman dealing with being old. And maybe I'm just not as empathetic to that. And that's a problem with me. Or maybe the storytelling. It's like Don Draper is a very difficult story to tell because they made us love him because of how smooth, attractive and put together he was before they took him apart. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like Amanda Peet, I was coming into a third season Don Draper losing his shit episode without any esteem for the character. In fact,
yeah,
the first scenes of the character is her acting like a crazy person in public to her daughter and to, you know, to the cab driver. Like she just to these people that like she was busy talking on the phone and she was obviously there alone and they took her chair and she turns it into this big thing about millennials. And I don't know. It's like right. Maybe it's that like if I knew Matthew Weiner, I wouldn't like him. But that seems way too that just seems way too me trying to understand my subjective reaction to this story. And take it out on the creator rather than just being like, wasn't for me.
Yeah, I mean, I felt you certainly at the beginning of this episode. I didn't like Amanda Peet. I didn't like her introduction. I didn't know enough about her to care. But I did feel by the end that I understood, like, the reason she doesn't come clean about this stuff is not for so many of the reasons you mentioned, but because she'd have to hurt somebody who she loves. Because I think she loves Eric, right? Like, there's this line. When is it? Sometime in the bookstore where Amanda Peet says to John Slattery, something like basically you're not Eric, which is both the reason I was with you and the reason I can't be with you long term. So like, I do think she loves Eric. It's just, she doesn't want to hurt him. So she can't tell him. She doesn't want to hurt her daughter. So she can't tell her daughter. And by the end, you know, she doesn't have to at least tell her daughter, but That's kind of what I thought was driving her, is her desire not to hurt someone she loves, which is a sympathetic thing.
Yeah, I guess. But on the other hand, I don't know. Like, it's the whole, I don't know. There's a lot of complicated, because I do believe that you shouldn't have extramarital affairs. If you'd have extramarital affair, it's 20 years in your past. I kind of think it's a dick move to bring it up just because it's personally got you in anguish.
I mean, with the complication of the daughter, yeah, that's
right.
And this
right.
coming granddaughter,
yeah, you know. And then like again, there's like trying to sell me on the story of like Daniel and like feeling sorry for him because he missed out on this relationship with his daughter or whatever. And he's just a creepy uncle. Like, I don't know. It feels like there is a lot. I guess that's the thing. It just felt like a whole episode of complaining about people's lot in life when they were the architect of that life and that lot.
Yeah,
you know, there was nothing in writing that made Daniel stick around New York and literally hover around his family and be the creepy uncle. You know, he betrayed his best friend. He fathered his best friend's daughter, and then he could have just like, okay, well, this is fucked. I'm going to exit, but like he chose to keep torturing himself in that way, in the same way that Julia chose to structure her family this way rather than be like, well, I committed infidelity. And I do think that there's something to, now that I've thought about it, that just there was nothing for me to like look at Julia and be like, well, this is something admirable. I mean, I guess the fact that she sticks with her mission at the home, at the homeless shelter, and despite of like being attacked, and it turned into just a massive, reactionary asshole about, well, these people are savages because I got attacked once. Like, that's kind of admirable, but
I also don't quite. I look at that and I go, what are her motivations here? Is she trying to do something good for the sake of doing something good, or is she trying to make herself feel better about the person she is?
Right. I can't be a bad person. I volunteer at the home, or I'm the director of the homeless shelter, and I look at how much stuff I do.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly, that's a bitch about altruism in general, because doing good makes you feel good. So is anything altruistic? And then you've, you know, there's stuff that's clearly self-serving, but it still does good. So is that altruistic? I don't know. It's really hard to keep score when you're talking about, like, at the societal level. But yeah, those are a lot of the conundrums, and maybe that's part of the art. I'm supposed to feel confused and conflicted about this, and hold it up as a mirror to my own life. And, you know, because there's a lot of also her mother, Juliet, she's trafficking in a lot of hard and fast rules. You know, like she has these things for her daughter, that her daughter is not checking off all these boxes of what she thinks is, you know, a responsible citizen of the world. Mm-hmm. And she's also, there's the rule that you never close the door. And there's all these other rules that she breaks in big ways. There's also the rule of, you know, you shouldn't cheat on your husband. especially with something messy as his best friend. And she violates all these rules, but yet simultaneously thinks that she's living a good life. Mm-hmm. Because it's a life that she wants her... Whereas, obviously, you know, if her daughter just breezily came into that brunch and been like, well, you know, yeah, sure, he's in Singapore, but of course I'm fucking his best friend. It's right here. And he's he's actually the father. It's okay, mother. You'll be fine. Amanda Peet would go thermonuclear, right? Because it's scary that her daughter is doing, like, the fact that in the real world, adults, that's part of being an adult, is knowing when it's okay to break a rule or making that decision for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's civil disobedience, that's speeding, that's doing drugs, that's premarital sex, that's, like, all these things are adults, like, adults get to ultimately get to choose and face the consequences of. And there's, like, something broken in Amanda Peet's character where she can't, she worries over much about other people breaking rules that she's just traipsing over. I'm not sure. You know, like if her husband said, came home and like, what have you been doing at work, honey? Oh, I've just been doing insider trading. It's cool. We're never going to get caught. Like, she'd freak out about that. But I don't know. She felt that's the other thing that kind of like was tickling around, that like, this character felt very hypocritical, which there's nothing wrong with writing bad, terrible, hypocritical characters. I just typically don't spend a lot of time watching it, except for, I guess, all 7 seasons of Mad Men. Maybe I'm a hypocrite.
Right, that's what I'm thinking. Like, a lot of people in the real world are like these characters. And
yes.
I guess that's the thing that I felt in this episode more than the other three, is that these could have been, with the exception of maybe episode 2, I think the cruise thing, like, I understood a lot of the emotions and the, you know, fucked up kind of mental processes that go into all of their decisions. Mm-hmm. But here, I definitely get it. Like, I get it. I think a lot of the choices are reprehensible. A lot of these things would be so much easier on you if you just told people, so much easier on you if you just avoided a mistake in the first place. Like, those things, I guess, didn't keep me from, like, understanding the emotional core of this episode, which I enjoyed. I thought it was good. I do have one question for you, though.
Yes.
Well, one big one. Why the locker room scene? Like, look, I like looking at naked women. That's not a problem. The problem is it felt weird and just kind of thrown in there for the sake of nudity.
Oh, see, I thought this was because, like, again, I saw this as a little bit of a middle-aged woman's crisis, and going past all these women, some of them younger than her, some of them older than her, some of them very pregnant, some of them, you know, like all these different bodies. And she was kind of, I don't know, like I got the feeling that like in so much of the other episode, she's judging, like, you know, this woman who's pregnant, and that made her remind her of her daughter. And she kind of has like a little face of, and then a woman walks past with pierced, like she's, like, her age, but she got pierced nipples, and she's like, you know, like, oh, what's this? And, you know, then the other girl kind of, like, giving her an eye. Like, I just felt like there was this all, like, she was, and maybe that's the thing that really pegged my hypocrisy alarm, is that she judges the world so much on other people's behavior, yet, mm-hmm. you know, she herself is kind of, like, weirdly giving herself a pass.
Yeah.
I don't know. She's, like, protected herself. Like, she's protect. She like, there's a lot of scenes of her protecting herself from, you know, getting taken advantage. Like, I'm gonna, you know, not leave my person as taxi cab drivers because this. I don't want to do this because I read this magazine that. And I don't, you know, and also, why does everyone hate her son-in-law's parents?
I don't know.
I mean, it is a neat trick that you cast this this lady that I'm trying to think, Mary Kay Place. She is kind of made a career of playing these overbearing, obnoxious, but well-meaning mothers. And she kind of does that in the little bit that she is. But, like, still, she seemed like the non-crazy one in comparison to Amanda Peet. And, you know, when I see, like, when I see her leading up to this, where she has gotten in this fight with these young people, and she is treated as cab driver like a piece of shit. Like, I don't know, maybe she's the proverbial, like, I got in mind that, like, and again, this is supposed to be the worst day of her life, I guess. I just got in mind that she's just, like, the proverbial asshole that goes out the door, and every person she meets is just a nightmare to deal with, and maybe it's because she's the nightmare?
Yeah, I think so. It's some weird, like, self-loathing kind of thing.
So, I don't know, like I said, it's interesting because I thought that you'd hate this episode too, and we could just talk about all the reasons we hate about it. The fact that you like would so, where would you judge this as far? Because I think it's fair to say that you have been none of the episodes have really caught your fancy.
Yeah,
they've been kind of droll experiences. Is this the one that's like, oh, I kind of get the Romanoffs now, or is it just the one that you did? Would you say you like this the most, or?
Yeah, I would say I probably like number two the most, and then this, and then maybe three, and then one.
Okay.
So far, this has not, like, hit the top. You know, it hasn't gone up and rang the bell or anything.
Right.
It's not that good.
No, I'm just saying in relation to the others.
Yeah, in relation to the others, this is probably the second best one so far for me, personally.
We kind of talked a little bit about there's a couple things that we visited in just passing, but I want to talk a little bit more of. The fantasy sequence.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this on Better Call Saul a lot, but anytime you do this, it's kind of important to give the viewers some clues that it's happening. And in this episode, when Julia is kind of fantasizing about the past, they have a completely different, like, palette to those flashback sequences to let you know. And it's good because I didn't think that they picked particularly good young Amanda Peets and John Slattery's to portray these. In fact, the first time it happened, if it weren't for the context of her literally doing the Wayne's World, like, I wouldn't know it was a flashback. And I felt like it was kind of bullshit to do the fantasy sequence and build this, and it's a really long, and there was no, like, nothing to kind of tip us off. I thought it was bull. I felt like I was jerked around when I realized that it had happened.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was confused. I'm like, but wait a second, I just watched her put on the, and then when she came out and her husband's watching Jeopardy, I'm like, oh, okay, I see what's happened. But I felt like it was a manipulation of the audience. What did you think?
I definitely felt a twinge of that when I watched it. And then, you know, after watching the episode and reflecting on it, I guess I came around to the idea that you need to understand, I guess, what she would wish for in that scenario. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, the fact that she doesn't just come out and we don't get a rehash of that scene, and maybe it goes a different place, maybe it doesn't, but she very much wishes that that could happen, and yet she's unwilling to even attempt it, right? I think that's the important thing that comes out of that. But I'm with you. I felt a little bit ripped off when I got done watching what was a beautiful, I thought, emotionally acted scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wouldn't have surprised me, too, to know that, like, the guy had suspected or what. I mean, I guess I was completely buying all the emotional parts. So then, you know, that's the other thing, I guess, it bugged me when we snap back from the fantasy sequence and she's resigned, like, well, that can never happen. I'm mm-hmm. like kind of screaming, why?
Yeah.
Why does this seem like something that can't ever happen? And, you know, that's the thing that bugged me, because it's, again, it's just her. It feels like she's, I don't know. What's the, she feels like she's catastrophizing, but in the wrong direction. Like, she just had a fantasy of how everything could go right, and she comes back and just immediately dismisses that. Whereas all of her fantasies mm-hmm. about all the things that can go wrong, like, oh, your husband's in Singapore because he's delayed a business trip 3 weeks because of your crazy pregnancy. Like, he's a monster because he might have to give blood. Like, that's the shit you're worried about. And yeah. it bugged me. I also wanted to cover the ground of, you seem very sure that the daughter, the final scene, the daughter actually knows her, who her true father is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what the final scene is about.
Okay. What? Because I think I agree with you, but I'm not sure why. Because the only thing, like, there's maybe a knowing look between her daughter and her at the end of that conversation, because she said, I love you too. And then maybe that she knew that she'd have to call Daniel from high. Like, I guess that's pretty obvious.
I mean, the fact that she called Daniel for her, like, yeah. I mean, it's the ending of that is, I think, undeniable.
Yeah.
She makes the phone call, hands the phone to her mom, listens to her say, I love you too. Mm-hmm. And then they look at each other and nod, like, they know, she knows.
So let me ask you this. What is the point of that scene supposed to be? The fact that Amanda Peet has been silly to do this much worrying, the fact that, it kind of belies Daniel's comment of being only the creepy uncle, because if the daughter, you know, recognizes him as more than that in her mom's life, then that probably means she's been more than that in her life too.
Mm-hmm.
A combination of all those things, something else.
Well, I think it's, you know, wrapped up pretty obviously in the gallstone operation that she has to have, right?
Yeah.
To get that removed. And the gallstone is very much representative of this feeling of guilt that she's carried with her. And I think this is the moment where she can begin to heal from that, because I don't want to look at this scene and say, oh yeah, no, her daughter knows, everything's fine now, because that's right. Not true. Her husband right. still doesn't know. There's still a lot of shit to deal with on that end. But like, this is the moment where she can finally say, okay, I've had this traumatic experience and I need to actually start healing from the pain that I felt for 20 years, you know?
Mm, right. Well, what else do you want to talk about?
The Romanoffs. So every episode of the Romanoffs, surprise, surprise, is tied to people who think they're part of the Romanoff family. Eric in this episode is the one who is a Romanoff descendant.
That's
or
Amanda
at least
Peet's
thinks
husband,
he is.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly, there are no other Romanoffs in this episode. You know, that like the ones who think who we think are Romanoffs at the beginning, the daughter, the granddaughter, none of them are. That part of the line is certainly not existing anymore. And I don't think has any Romanoff spouse ever taken the Romanoff name in this show? Cause didn't Noah Wiley and Carrie Bichet say that neither one of them did.
I'm not sure about Carrie. I think Wiley for sure. Cause why would he? That's like, if you're going to observe, I mean, it's certainly not tradition for the man to take the woman's name. Increasingly, it seems like that tradition's kind of, I know people like are whatever. It used to be kind of avant-garde thing if you refuse to take your husband's name or like hyphenated. And now it's kind of like, I don't think anyone cares.
I mean, the Romanoff should, right? Like, if they're all about, they have their own societies and shit.
No, but it's funny that you have this like kind of cuckoo relationship where the Romanoff name will be carried on by a non-Romanoff.
Yeah.
And I also thought, like, as I was sitting there and making my notes over to end credits, I was thinking, this isn't the first time. Like how many of these supposed, like, bloodlines, these old blue bloodlines, have this kind of shit going, like, this kind of Jaime and Cersei Lannistering going on?
Right.
You know, like, it's kind of funny how much like stock that we put in for just centuries and millennia of this royal blood, and how you know, for some of them take it more or less serious, but the Romanovs, as portrayed in this show, still do. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's like, it's how many of the Romanovs are even still legitimate Romanovs at this point?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I just thought it was interesting. The show at this point seems to be building the pattern of none of the people who marry into the Romanovs want anything to do mm-hmm. with the Romanov legacy, you know?
Yeah. It does seem like that, like, another thesis of the show is there is this psychic trauma that's happened to the Romanovs because of the upheaval and because of things were ripped away from them. But
yeah,
you know, I don't know how much stock there that I'd take in that either. I was also kind of thought it was weird that Daniel's character, like, he's made his bones writing about the Romanovs because his best friend is a Romanov.
I think so. Yeah, they mentioned some consulting that Eric did.
Does that track for you?
It maybe depends on when they met, how long they've been friends. Because I could see, like, you know, you're in school. Maybe he wanted to be a writer, right? And you're in school and you're thinking, oh, fuck, what am I going to do for this project?
What's interesting hook I can think of?
Yeah, Eric's Romanov. Maybe I could just interview him, you know, and condense that down into a few chapters.
Yeah, and then it just blows maybe up from there. If that's what you've had success, it's like,
yeah,
you know, we didn't envision ourselves being successful television podcasters. It's just that's the podcast that was most successful, and here we are years later talking about the Romanovs.
If I knew a Romanov, maybe it'd be the Romanovs, bald right. Romanovs.
Right. If I was best friends with Matthew Weiner, I'd write a I'd write a show about a dynasty of showrunners called the Wieners. And the little wieners, and it'd be like Seth Rogen hot dog movie,
Sausage Party.
Yeah, it'd be like Sausage Party. It'd be that animation. All of the main characters would be wieners, and they're producing television, and that's it. It's like a BoJack Horseman thing where everyone's wieners except for people that aren't.
You know, we can still make that happen. There's nothing stopping it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's all I've got to talk about. Do you have any other closing thoughts?
No, I think that's about it.
Before we get into feedback, I'd like to talk about the club, club.baldmove.com. That is a way for listeners to directly support our podcasts. And that's important because it allows us to cover some of the smaller shows that are off the major networks, such as the Romanovs, the one that you're enjoying right now. And it also allows us to be full-time podcasters and give you more quality content. There's so many bonus features you get for joining the club. You can go to club.baldmove.com and preview them right now. But there are ad-free feeds. There are ways to watch us record the podcast on video. There's just entirely new shows like Quit Your Pitchin' and Lunch with Jim and Aaron that we do just for club members. You can get a free sample of all those at club.baldmove.com. You can also get a free 30-day trial just for signing up. Again, club.baldmove.com. Let's get into feedback, which you can send to tv@baldmove.com, or we have a Romanovs thread on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. First up, Dan from Manchester. At first, I was on the fence about the Romanovs as I couldn't wrap my head around the concept of people being so messed up about a generational suffering, but as the season goes on, I think I'm starting to understand how something that happened 100 years ago could still be on your mind and how you feel you had a birthright taken away. I do think this show would work better if it was about a single family of Romanovs that were all bitter and messed up rather than the format we have now. I think Weiner could get his concept across a lot more that way. It's so funny to see that this is the episode that I'm taking Dan as face value, because why wouldn't I? But to me, it's so bizarre to see this one where I think the Romanovs plot was so far off into the side. This is the one where it kind of clicks together.
Yeah, that is weird, because I didn't feel any Romanov stink on this episode at all.
Romanov stink.
Yeah.
Romanov aroma. To me, this was the Romanovs couldn't even mention at all. Like, the Romanovs were like three lines in a script, and like, whatever damage Julia's got, I certainly don't think it's around being a Romanov.
No.
By marriage. But also, another interesting data point, Dan says, I would like to mention I'm 29 years old now and is a huge fan of Mad Men that started watching the show on air at 21. So you guys weren't, in fact, the youngest members of the audience.
Lies. Yeah. Lies. I don't believe it.
This whole email. This whole email is a pack of lies, Dan. Just come on. Be like Julia. Just be like Julia. Just get it out there. I know every time in Mad Men where we talked about how we were the youngest people watching it, we'd get like a teenager or something. So yeah, I get it. I was like 14 watching Northern Exposure. Had no business watching that show.
Can't make a joke on this podcast without getting emails, huh?
Nah, you cannot. You cannot. You're going to get...
That in mind.
You're going to get correct. No, it's going to be a much serious podcast from Jim going forward.
Yeah, no more jokes.
Next up, my jam. I watched this episode, but didn't click for me. The first three kept me engaged in watching, but I found my attention wandering in this one. I think Amanda Peet's character was not relatable, and she played it a bit odd. I was getting a hint of a screwball comedy vibe from her, her role as a pushy, entitled woman. But no one was laughing. The other characters just basically said she was a bitch or they let it go. And the daughter was kind of unlikable for me as well. But I have been enjoying the anthology overall, and there were some good things about this episode. In spite of my estimate of her performance, I liked seeing Amanda Peet again and John Slattery and Diane Lang for the brief time she was in the episode. And downtown New York looked so great. It made me want to visit. Yeah, Weiner gave New York the full Paris treatment.
Yeah,
made it seem like a really great place to be. I feel every bit of your feedback because I got the whole screwball comedy. It's like a screwball comedy, except for instead of being like playing up the laughs, they played up the drama. It was too funny and too odd for me to take seriously as a drama, and is way too glib about everything for me to take it serious as a drama. And it just kind of lived in that tonal no man's land for me. That worked against my enormous esteem that I have for Peet and Slattery and like Diane Lang. Like, I wonder if she's going to be in another future episode, because otherwise
maybe
it's just like she parachuted in for two or three sentences and it was out. Like, I don't want to say it's a criminal misuse of her, because whatever, but kind of it's a big name and a really well liked like a really likable actor brought in for a fairly forgettable role. That didn't usually happen in Mad Men.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. She might show up later. And specifically in those scenes, I think that's the one where she's at the restaurant or whatever, out on the patio. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to charge her cell phone. Like, I think Matthew Weiner has an idea in his head of how funny he wants to be and how much drama he wants to inject. And story be damned, tone be damned, he's going to jam that in there. And I feel like this episode... the number one complaint I had is about the tone and the lack of the fun. In order to pull off what he's trying to pull off, we have to fundamentally understand these characters. And with this format, you just don't get in their headspace enough to do that.
Yeah. Very curious that this is the shortest episode so far, too, because I felt like there could have been what this thing needed is about 20 minutes of showing Amanda Peet and her husband having everything totally together.
Yeah.
Like, you should just be able to get that this is a clockwork couple and everything, like, are just finely meshed teeth, and it's turning, like, he's got this high-powered legal career or whatever the fuck it's got, and she's got this philanthropy thing, and then her daughter arrives in New York, and they're going to have brunch, and that's where the wheels come off. You start seeing the cracks, but, like, not getting any of that.
And that would have been great, too, because then you could say, oh, well, when she... isn't constantly reminded of her infidelity and this huge mistake, it kind of goes to the back of her mind and she's able to pretend like she has some normal life, right?
Yeah.
But then, her daughter shows up. It reminds her, much like all of the scenes we saw of her touching a doorknob or smelling a perfume or whatever,
right,
remind her of that moment. This could have been the bigger reminder, her daughter herself.
Yeah. Moving on to Demick. They wonder, did Weiner just basically recycle the brunch scene with Roger and his daughter Margaret from episode one of season 7 of Mad Men? The dynamic and tension were so similar between Julia and Ella. He even used the same word serene to describe both Margaret and Ella. Do you remember that scene?
Not in any kind of detail. No, I was thinking of other Roger moments that tie to this episode, but
I felt like there's a blend of that. There's also a little, there's a lot of Trudy, was that Pete Campbell's wife's name?
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of Trudy and her and Amanda Peet's daughter. You know, okay. This kind of like likable and beautiful, but kind of shallow socialite kind of role. And thinks that that's like, well, you know, she, but doesn't feel like there's anything to, there's nothing like, I don't know. That's such a weird character. Like, I don't know. I guess there's all kinds of ways to rebel. And if your parents have raised you to be a socially conscious person and you just reject all that and without any kind of reflection over how privileged it is, maybe that would grate. But I don't know. Cause I think I've always understood one of the goals of feminism to be that women should be free to be any kind of woman they want, including a housewife.
Yeah. So, no, we talked about that on the Sharp Objects podcast. Right. There was an episode where it was really brought to the fore.
Right. It's super weird to see. And that's like one of those things, like maybe that's an early annoyance is like, does Matthew Weiner understand the goals of feminism to have like supposedly a feminist social, you know, socially conscious woman to be this brittle and fragile and rigid in her ways? I don't know.
Yeah, I think he might be doing something there to say, you know, that there is that hypocrisy within her because like,
yes,
normally this is depicted the other way around, right? Where the very conservative mother says, oh, you shouldn't be out there doing the things you're doing because blah, blah, blah.
You're looking at all you're missing out. And that's what, yeah.
Right. Here, it's the very, not like housewife conservative mother. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. The daughter is that way.
Right.
Here's the other thing related to Mad Men that I noticed about this episode is like, John Slattery is essentially playing Roger in the later seasons of Mad Men with Joan. And is it a daughter? A son that they have together?
Oh, right. Yeah. Son.
Son that they have together. I felt like that worked much better than it did here because of everything we knew about Roger and Joan up to that point.
Right. And it's also weird because, you know, obviously Roger... Roger. Obviously, John's gotten a little bit older since his Mad Men days, so it kind of... I understand it doesn't work as a characterization, but I... Now that he's looking more and more like an aging playboy, like, I do feel that his face kind of brought to the role this kind of, like, essential sadness of, like, you know, that I've watched this other man live my life and been helpless. I just stood by and let it happen. Like, he's now old enough to start having regrets. Like, I'm not going to, like, I've got this cold relationship with my wife and I don't have any children. And maybe that's something I wanted and I couldn't appreciate that when I was younger. And now it's something I can't have. Like, that it works because he's just, you know, a little older now.
Yeah.
It was weird because I thought him and Amanda Peet had zero chemistry. In fact, when they first met, like, I thought they were posing him as the grandfather. And I'm like, wait a second. John Slattery is only like 8 years older than Amanda Peet. What the hell? But then it's like when they did the flashback, I'm like, oh, they're supposed to be like romantically connected. And I felt like they had a fraternal or paternal type of affection, and I never bought the love story, which maybe is why they I don't know, really went for broke selling the 50 Shades aspect of their intense sexual chemistry in their youth.
What is it about John Slattery? I look at this from a meta aspect and I'm like, is John Slattery destined to be his character in this episode where like he looks back and says, I was always the guy cast as the aging playboy or as the guy who was like always the lover, never the father kind of thing. Like, is it something about his appearance, something about his mannerisms? Is it like, what is it where he plays this kind of character over and over again?
I don't know. There is something about how ridiculously I think he's ridiculously good looking and also because of his preternaturally gray hair, charming and distinguished.
Yeah,
that lets him kind of be like this George Clooney type, where he is, you know, he could be a CEO, or he could be a playboy, or he could be a father, or even a grandfather. There's like he could do a lot, and you know, also he's got a successful career as a director and producer. So like, I don't know if he's. If being cursed to John Slattery, then I could use a little bit of that curse.
Fair.
To be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But let us. Do you have anything else you want to say, or should we move on?
No, let's keep going.
Actually, we're not even done with the Dimmick's email. Says, I think we're supposed to see Julie as unlikable. I agree. However, we're also looking on possibly one of the most stressful days of her life. The decades-long lie about her daughter's biological father. Her child making choices she couldn't understand. Her child making life choices that she couldn't understand, and aging. I think there's examples of her being a decent, caring person in general. Out of all the people on the street, she's the one stopping and helping the mother with the stroller navigating a revolving door. She continued to work at the homeless outreach organization after she was getting physically assaulted, etc. You know, that's a good point. The whole, that scene, I think Matthew Weiner was cognizant of what we were talking about, and he threw in that early scene. That's our first real introduction to Amanda once she leaves her apartment and into the world, right? She helps that young mother struggling with getting a baby thing through the door.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's like, I did my job. Everyone knows that Juliet is a likable, good person, and now I can have her proceed to act a fool the rest of the episode.
Uh-huh.
But if so, I felt like that's a little bit of a miscalculation.
No, it's funny because I think you hit it, like, we needed actually a longer episode. This is the shortest episode yet. We've complained about how long these episodes are, and yet this is the first one that feels like it needed that amount of time, and it didn't get it.
Yeah, it just was missing a few character beats that would have fleshed it out and gotten the impact I think he's looking for. I have a feeling that Eric was right, that Daniel never really grew up. If he wanted to be more involved in Ella's life, there was ways to be more than a creepy fake uncle. However, the look on his face when he watched Eric walk Ella down the aisle was so heartbreaking that you couldn't help but feel for him. Julia's imaginary confession scene was my favorite of the episode. I could see her rehearsing the speech she had in her head over and over for 20 years. From what she knew of her husband and because of what a decent, loving person he was, she believed he would forgive her and still love her, but nonetheless, she never had the courage to be completely honest with him. How do you live with a lie so big? And the grand scheme of things, whoever Ella's father was probably makes very little difference, but to Julia, the weight of her betrayal, deception, and guilt is almost crushing, which is something that Weiner does best. I mean, there's certainly something in that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I imagine the way Julia does is, like, when she gets busy in her regular life, this all fades into the background, and she can almost pretend like it never happened. It's only, and it's ironically probably the biggest moments, the happiest moments of a parent's life, when your child graduates school, when your child gets married, when your child is having the child of their own. And as contrast, we see the son-in-law's parents gushing about how this is going to be the happiest day of your life because this is like all love and fun and none of the discipline and worry. And yet it's times like these where Daniel's character starts to muscle in and wants to, and then she just has to relive all this horror. So, like, you know, all the red letter days are these black letter days for her.
That's a really good point. And there's a line in there in the fantasized confession about, you know, the mistake, the lie was big then. It's so much bigger now.
Right.
And when you look at that moment about what's about to happen here with her daughter being pregnant, about to give birth to yet another generation that she would have to confess to not being Eric's. How much bigger is that lie getting right now, you know?
Yeah, or you've got a whole generation of people that are going to believe this lie. I mean, it's compounding. And I mean, that's, like I said, interesting piece of analysis. I just, and it's something that some of this stuff makes me intellectually like the episode more in retrospect. But again, I wish some of that stuff was better, like that point was better made. So it was more self-evident and something I was able to appreciate, because I was just like, yeah, at the one-third mark, I was so turned off by, I was clinging for a character that, and I'm like, oh, John Slattery's here to save the day. And then no, it turns out that not, because that's the other thing is like, how big of an asshole do you have to be to demand that you get a place at this table at this stage in the game? You know, like you've been the creepy uncle this whole time, and now at this big day for everybody, like, and it's your best friend. He's getting his like first grandchild. Like, well, how big of a narcissist or asshole do you be? Like, but what about my feelings? Take that shit to your therapist, man.
Well, he's been doing nothing about that. I mean, he's emotionally constipated over his daughter, right? Like, it's been 20 years. He has done everything that she has asked to hide this secret because it's not really his place to blow up her life
except
if she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
But but it's coming to a head. Like, he can't stand by, watch another generation of his family be born without being a part of it. Mm-hmm. So I get it. And you're not wrong either that, you know, this is a terrible time to be interjecting and demanding a seat at the table. But, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes the heart wants what the heart wants, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the head be damned.
Yeah. And then I guess my question would be, or what? Like, you know, when you said, like, he's not going to step by, it's like, but yeah, but you got to. Like, you know, a lot of that.
Well, he's desperate. I mean, he's an old man. He's going through the same aging crisis, you know, this midlife thing that she's talking about.
Sure. Sure. Like I keep coming back to, well, you fucked up, you know, like there's no way at this point in time to unfuck this situation. So now, like, you know, what are you going to do? But then again, his whole character is about arrested development. So,
right.
I mean, there's a very good chance that he would get what he wants and becomes a big part of this family's life. And the second someone had to depend on him, he'd be like, whoop, time to do a Romanoff cruise. And then just like disappear, like
sure.
The proverbial go out to get a bag of, get a pack of smokes and never come back. So I don't know. There's just something that was hard. Like with both these characters just seem so primarily self-centered. That's the thing that always bugged me, mm-hmm. is that none of this anguish or pain was coming because of what anything else had done except for the feelings that they were having. And I get it. You can also just easily say, well, but that's another way of saying that she's afraid to hurt her husband, and she's afraid to hurt her daughter and all that. But, mm-hmm. you know, she's in the unique position where she can contain all that suffering to one human body, her own.
Right. Until it rebels and kills her.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, she's, yeah, that's not the appropriate penalty to pay for that. I don't know what I'm saying.
The sweet release. Wasn't there something about that in here?
Yes, it's when the credits started rolling.
Yeah.
That's all we got for feedback. You can send in more to tv@baldmove.com, or you can get in on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. We'll be back with another episode of Romanoffs next week, same as Weiner. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.